think about priorities in our lives, it could be said that for the most part, they are determined by circumstance. Circumstantial priorities can really be a problem. It means that we spend our lives putting out fires. It prevents us from being intentional and proactive. And it can also cause us to be distracted to the point that we miss whatever may be most important in the moment. It's an interesting concept to consider that circumstantial priorities guide most of our days, and yet if we think about it and kind of think through the day, we'll probably come to the conclusion that that is true. On the other hand, value-driven priorities are something that supersede our circumstances, and so when we have clear values, truth, in other words, that defines what we believe, what we think, and our overall worldview and philosophy of life, then as the circumstances arise, we apply those values to our response. So rather than responding out of the circumstance or whatever may be driving it or whomever may be driving it, we respond based on a value that guides everything and evaluates everything. So the purpose of discipleship is to help us to grow in our understanding of what it means to be a follower of Christ, and in the process, we come into a greater knowledge of God and understanding of His truth that not only defines who we are in relationship to Him, but now defines everything else around us so that as we experience life and all of its circumstances, those values and that definition inform our responses so that we respond based on truth rather than the demand of any given moment. Again, I'll leave it to you to apply it in specific terms, and I'll stick to the general ones, but generally speaking, this is similar to some of the things that were happening in the church in Colossae. Paul wrote to them because he had learned from their leader Epaphras that they were having these problems. False teachers arose within the church and told them that giving themselves to the truths of God was one way to live, but it wasn't the only one that God would honor, and that they could also have whatever vices the world offered that brought some sort of sensual pleasure, and it would not compromise their commitment to God. Now, this is a clear lie that violates everything that the Bible teaches, but nonetheless, these persuasive people were using their position of intellectual superiority to overwhelm the people there. They also were introducing circumstantial evidence, and the community that surrounded them was a heavy press in the same way that our social structures influence our behavior. In that same way, social structure was influencing the church then. They also told them that truth wasn't as important as emotions, so that how you feel is more important than what you know. Again, this is a circumstantial priority. Emotions are circumstantial. How do you feel in any given moment? Yes, there are times when you may find yourself in a vacuum and nothing from the external world around you really influencing in you, and you either feel good or you feel bad. But most of the time, we are engaged in the world around us in such a way that there are external factors influencing our emotions, and the emotions rise and fall based on those external factors. Very inconsistent. What they were saying was, if you come to church and you have an emotional upheaval and experience, then you've experienced everything you need. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. The Bible doesn't in any way endure such overly emotional responses that do not lead to genuine transformation. So if what you're feeling in worship, what you're feeling in the study of the Word, feeling when you are encountering God, does not translate into how you're living, there's a disconnect. Doesn't necessarily mean the feeling is wrong. It does mean that it isn't complete. The other thing that they were telling them was that it wasn't just about an emotional response. It wasn't just about giving themselves to the ways of the world along with the ways of God. They were also saying there were certain things that they needed to do. Not many, but if they didn't do these certain things, then things weren't going to happen for them, and they wouldn't ultimately experience salvation. In other words, what they were introducing was a legalistic system. Now, keep in mind that every society that has existed since the beginning has attempted to do the very thing that we see here. So this is not new information. It's just very specific and uniquely relevant to our setting today. So every society has attempted to do this by saying, look, if you do this, this, and this, then you're going to be blessed. In other words, you now are your own God. You don't really need God. God is obligated to bless you because of what you did. And what the Bible teaches is that God is not obligated in any way to bless us, but that rather out of His grace and mercy, His blessing pours forth so that we respond with humility and surrender. On the other hand, if your salvation is because you did this and that, now it depends on you and you have no obligation of surrender or allegiance to God. You have become preeminent. That's not true, but it's not new. And so when Paul writes to the Colossians, he is doing so to counteract the influence of these false teachers and the way they are leading people astray, causing them to be dragged down in the process. What they were doing was watering down the gospel and watering down the truth of God so that faith in Christ became a religion but not the. And rather than Jesus being the one and only Savior, now He has become a Savior among many. And in their minds, it was enough that Jesus was prominently considered, but it was never enough that He would be preeminent and alone. The Bible, in turn now, teaches us the exact opposite. It reminds us that Jesus is preeminent. So the preeminence of Christ is what we see in Colossians 1 in verses 15 through 23. And as we do so, we learn it from a number of different perspectives. Paul wants us to understand that Jesus is preeminent and sovereign over all of creation. Look what he says in verse 15. He is the image of the invisible God and the firstborn of all creation. The word image is the same word that we use today that we typically apply to a photograph. And so something that will capture the image of another. Back in their day, they would have thought of it in reference to perhaps a governmental leader's face that appears stamped on a coin or something like that. But then this word also has a nuance associated with it that definition does not capture. And the nuance is this. From the biblical perspective, when we speak of the image of Christ or the image of God being fully revealed through the preeminence of Jesus Christ, His Son, what we are describing is not just this representation, but also a manifestation. It isn't just that Christ is revealing what God looks like. He is revealing the very presence and power and authority of God as well. What did Jesus say to his disciples when he knew that his time here was going to come to a close? He said, "And I will be with you always." The presence, the manifestation, when the Bible says that Jesus is the image of the invisible God, and when we speak of that theme over and over through this study of the book of Colossians, what we are talking about is that Jesus represents God in our hearts, in our minds, in our lives, and in the world around us, but He also reveals God in a way that brings the very presence and power of God to bear in all of these circumstances, representation and manifestation, because He's Lord of creation. Verse 15. But He is also prominent over creation. In the latter part of verse 15, it says He's the firstborn of all creation. Because of the use of the term firstborn, there are some groups, even today, that still teach that Jesus is a created being, that He is not God. And so be very, very careful. If you want to know how to talk to the people who come to your doorstep to talk to you about becoming a Jehovah's Witness, or who come to the doorstep to talk to you about becoming a Mormon, begin with your conversation regarding who Jesus Christ is. Ask them, is He created or is He God? Ask them whether or not He is someone like God or He is God. These are the kinds of things that will reveal to you a greater understanding of the perspective that many people have. I'm not trying to bash some other group or some other person. What I'm trying to do is reveal truth, and we cannot do that if we veer from the understanding that Jesus Christ is fully man, but fully and completely God, thereby not created, but creator. Please, please understand that if we sacrifice even a moment of understanding regarding who Jesus is, we now have begun the path down false teaching and destruction. Jesus is God. So the word firstborn has nothing to do with Him being created or born into existence the way you and I associate that, but rather it has to do with position. And so when it speaks of Him as firstborn of all creation, it is speaking of Him as a positional authority over all creation. Jesus is the representation and manifestation of God, but He is also prominently featured as sovereign over all creation. And this phrase speaks of that in a way that is clear and is repeatable throughout the New Testament. Jesus is also the agent of creation, so that it comes from the very mind of Christ Himself. In verse 16, it says, "For by Him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authority." The statement here is a reminder to us that creation has come into existence as a result of the creative work of Christ. So how do we understand the Trinity? If you figure that out, especially if you can do so before the end of this sermon, I would appreciate it if you'd come up afterwards and share that information with me. Because I don't know that the mind of man, and not just because mine doesn't, but because I don't think any can fully comprehend the very nature of God as we see Him on display through the Trinity. But I don't have to fully and completely comprehend this reality in order to believe that it's true. If I had to have full comprehension of every circumstance, every principle, or everything that I know in order for it to be true, there would be an awful lot of stuff that I rely on that I'd need to reject. What we're learning here, what we're seeing here, is that Christ is the agent, the means by which creation comes into existence. That means you and I owe our existence to Him. He is the creator God. So that when we think of Jesus in His redeeming work, we must also be reminded that everything that exists came into existence because of Him. Without Him, nothing that exists would have existed. And through Him, everything that is here holds together. Again, the focus is glorifying Jesus. It is glorifying God, but it is also reminding us of his preeminence. Jesus is not only the agent of creation, but he's the goal of creation. The latter part of verse 16 says that all things were created through him and for him. Now, I skipped over the powers and the dominions and the authorities and the rulers and all of this kind of stuff. Is it talking about governmental leaders on this earth, or is it talking about spiritual authorities that exist in the realm that we do not see? I think it's both, and it's hard for me to distinguish one from the other, and it's hard for me to explain that because the Bible doesn't give us complete information about it. I can speculate along with everyone else who speculates, and if you want to do that, that's fine. However, the point of it is oftentimes lost in the speculation regarding the details of who's being defined. This is illustrative, which means that he gave this in order to illustrate the reality that Christ is the means by which all has been created, and that includes what you and I see, and it includes what we don't. In so doing, what he has done is define for us the reality of the physical world, but also the reality of the spiritual world, and that he has unified the two of them by reminding us Jesus is preeminent over them all. And that all of it, both the spiritual and the physical, exist for the glory of God, so that it is created through him, but also to him. How does creation then exist for the glory of God? Well, I hope you can figure that out, because that's the very purpose statement of our church. Temple Baptist Church exists for the glory of God through lives transformed by the gospel of Jesus Christ. The only reason that we exist as a church, the only reason that anything in this world exists at all, is in order to glorify God. Not because God is in need of some sort of worship. He is sufficient in and of himself. But because by his grace he has enabled us to know him in this most intimate way, so that as we live to his glory, we find our own greatest fulfillment. It's an act of grace and mercy. Jesus is the goal of creation so that we live to his glory. Verse 17 tells us that he is before creation. It says, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Again, we see his prominence featured before all creation. We see over and over, as the Bible speaks of creation, as you and I understand it, from the Genesis account, it reminds us that there's a plural that existed before anything else did. And so God often refers to the plurality of the Godhead, reminding us that even in the most ancient of times, Jesus always was, because God always was. So Jesus is before creation, and the sole purpose of this is just a restatement of his prominence and sovereignty over it. Again, in the same way that firstborn speaks of the blessing of authority, in this same way, the positional aspect of him being before anything then subsumes everything that comes after under him. So because Christ existed before, all creation then is subservient to him. But it says not only is before all things, but in him all things hold together. So what happens if Jesus goes away? Well, number one, you don't even have to imagine that, because it can't happen. It just can't. I think that you and I have a grave responsibility and a strong sense of accountability as believers and disciples of Jesus Christ to live in the world in a way that honors him, and in a way that is going to direct others to him, and in a way that allows us to display and show forth the love that we have for him through love and care to one another. I believe that with everything in me. I think that it's easy for us to understand. It's one of the most basic fundamental discipleship principles. Love God and love others. That's it. You get that right, everything else comes right pretty quick, pretty quickly. And so the statement here about this is something that I think is It cannot be overstated. But when we say that everything exists through him, but everything exists for him, what we are also saying is that Christ is the one who holds all this together. So we're all part of a very specific plan and a very specific process. So while we bear the accountability and responsibility that God has given us in the moments of life that we are blessed to be a part of, and we do those to the best of our ability, we must always do them in the full awareness that there is an authority that resides over all of us and over all of the things that seem to be out of control. Nothing is ever out of control. It may not seem that way. It may not feel like that. And I understand. But the truth is what's going to define our response, not the circumstance. Here's another illustration of what happens when we let circumstances, especially when they get out of control, when we let circumstances dictate truth and dictate our belief. We start acting now on an out-of-control situation, which means we're either going to attempt to control it, which you cannot do, or we're going to attempt to just go along with it and be out of control as a part of the chaos. And that's not going to help either. And so we can stand in the midst of the storms of life. We can stand in the midst of the chaos of a world that is in the process of dying and know that there is order. And God is in control. Everything's holding together because of him. And I don't want you to get the image that he's just barely keeping it together. This is not like, man, he's got a grip on it, but it's pulling hard and it's about to come apart. It's not like that. It's not like that. It's never like that. It will never be like that. There is no power. There is no force. There is no ability. Everything that exists was made by him. And he holds it all together until such time as he makes it new. And so the preeminence of Christ is given to us in a way that helps us to understand that this created existence that we are a part of, all has come into existence because of Christ. It is sustained by Christ. Therefore, Christ deserves preeminence. But he deserves preeminence not only in creation, but also in redemption. Look at verse 18. It says, "And he is the head of the body, the church." Jesus is the head of the body, which is the church. Body and church are a common theme that Paul uses to illustrate. It reminds us that the unity exists between the head and the body. So while the world doesn't see Christ necessarily, they see the church. It is the way that the church lives, directed by Jesus, that ultimately brings the world to Christ. They may not see the head, they see the body. But as they get to know the body, it should always point to the head. The unity of the head and the body also reminds us not only of giving glory to Christ, but also as a church or as a part of the church at large. You and I are a uniquely set apart part of God's plan. And what does that mean? Well, it means this. When you read through the Bible, how many institutions do you find? Two. Right? First one is marriage. I didn't hear what you said. Nope. First one is marriage. Marriage existed before the church. First institution. Second one is church. So, when he wanted to describe the church in Ephesians, how did Paul describe it? He described it as a marriage. So that marriage is, on earth, the clearest expression and example of the relationship that exists between Christ and the church. So what does that mean? Well, it means the church is all messed up and broken. And I think a lot of times our efforts to try to make it appear otherwise are just empty and vain. If we had it all figured out, our marriages would be perfect and our church would be perfect. We don't have it all figured out, and we're not going to. Therefore, there's an awful lot of imperfection. It does not in any way diminish the value of the grace that sustains us. When we see this, what we're seeing is the chosen nature of the relationship between Christ and the church. This unity that exists is necessary to the plan and purpose of God by His choice. So that this is repeated over and over throughout the Bible. It speaks of the necessity of the unity between the church and Christ, and it reminds us that this is not just something that is a requirement. This is a fantastic privilege that allows us to be a part of a body that ultimately brings glory to the head. It also speaks of not only a unity, but also authority. So again, we see the authority. Remember, we're talking about redemption. Christ is preeminent in redemption. How did the church come into existence? Because He made it so. Verse 18 reminds us then, He is the head of the body of the church. He is the beginning and firstborn from the dead, so that in everything He might be preeminent. Jesus is the head of the body, the church, but He is also the beginning. He is first in priority, first in authority. This is a repetition of some of the things I've already said, but here the distinction is that it is applied to the redeeming work of God through His grace in Jesus Christ. So He is the beginning with regard to redemption. He is exclusive. So the Bible tells us then that He is the way, the truth, and the life. But we forget He is the only way, the only truth, and the only means of life. First in priority, first in authority. This is what it means when He said He is the beginning. The resurrection is the display of the supremacy of Christ in this redeeming work, so that when He says in this last part of the verse, firstborn from the dead, He is referring again to the first one to be resurrected. Now, is that true? Is He the first one to be resurrected? He is the first one to be resurrected in a way that He would never die again. There were others who were brought back from the dead, but only to die again. Jesus did not. Jesus is the firstborn, and He is the preeminent one, so that the resurrection displays His supremacy in redemption, meaning that after He died for sins and rose for justification, then He would never die again. And the fact that He didn't, and that He is seated at the right hand of the throne of God Himself, is the reminder to us that the redemption that He offers is sufficient for your need. Yes, He can save you. The resurrection then displays the redemption of the supremacy of Jesus in redemption. The work of Jesus then is to reconcile us and to bring us home. It shows us in full measure in verses 19 and 20. For in Him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through Him to reconcile to Himself all things, whether on earth or heaven, making peace by the blood of His cross. Excuse me. The resurrection displays the supremacy of Jesus in His redeeming work by showing us the full measure of deity. So He is the full representation, the full manifestation of God. There is an interesting word that appears in the Bible repeatedly, especially in the New Testament, and it is a word that means to know. And we see it a lot. Now, we don't take note of it because it's common, and we don't really think of it with depth. But have you thought about what it means to know, in this regard, God? To know God is more than to know about God. It's more than to know who God is. Have you ever had those conversations where people try to help you to understand who someone is that you don't know? My dad will do this all the time. I was talking to so-and-so. You know him. He works down at so-and-so. No? Yeah, he married so-and-so. I don't know who that is, Dad. Well, they have four children, and their names are, and he starts going through it. It's not going to matter how much information you provide. I don't know who this person is. So then he'll say it louder. Some of you do that to me, too. The bottom line is, if you haven't met someone and you don't have a relationship with that person, you don't know them. Now, if you've seen them or you've seen them with some of these associations that are being described, you may be able to make a connection, at least have some recognition of the person, but you still don't know them. The word know, as the Bible describes it for us, is a word that goes beyond recognition. It is a word that goes even beyond the kind of information that would create these connections and associations. It actually is describing for us what you and I understand is intimacy. To know someone intimately is to know them in a way by which you have been willing to risk everything in the relationship. Intimacy has nothing to do with sensuality, although it certainly can. Intimacy has everything to do with vulnerability. God, I really, really want this. But if it's not your will, then don't let me have it. But in your mind, what you're thinking is, but I really, really want it. And I want it to be your will. And if it's not your will, just let's figure out a way to make it so. Vulnerability is where we say, God, I want what you want, even if it means me not getting what I think I want right now. Intimacy is, God, I want to know you, even if knowing you means that I'm going to know myself more than I care to. It means, God, I want to know you, and I want to be known by you, so that I can be known by others in the way that you know me, and realize that that's not always going to be comfortable either. When he talks about this kind of relationship, he is speaking of the kind of intimacy that is associated with the relationship, knowing God. That's why when Jesus says, or when Paul says with regard to Jesus, that in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, what he was saying to us, if you want to know God at the intimate level that is being described here, then you must have an intimate relationship with Jesus. The work of Jesus is to reconcile all creation, bringing peace through the cross. So he says it in that same way, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. Ultimately, it is the sacrifice of Jesus that makes possible the reconciliation of man to God. So that through Jesus Christ, we trust that when he died on the cross and when he shed his blood for us, that God looked at that sacrifice and said, this is enough to satisfy the requirement of sin. Verses 21 through 23, then he gives a personal application. Let me hasten to give it to you. The personal application says, and you who once were alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds. He reminds us who we are before salvation. Before our salvation through Jesus Christ, we are outside the blessing of God. We are enemies of God. And the result of our sin nature is worked out in our lives through evil deeds, doing evil things. This is what he means when he says alienated, hostile in mind, and doing evil things. All of this is before salvation. But after salvation, look at how it changes. Verse 22, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death in order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach. So that after salvation, the means of salvation being the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross and resurrection to life forevermore. So that the purpose of salvation is applied to us specifically so that he can present all believers holy, blameless, above reproach. It means just this, very simply, that we have been justified by grace sacrificially, we have been justified by grace judicially, and we have been justified by grace generally, so that there is nothing that remains. We are redeemed, reconciled, restored, given hope, filled with purpose, and living under the awareness that all that exists, exists for His glory and remains forever under His control. Now, knowing this and seeing all of that, how does it change your view, or how does it strengthen your understanding of Christ? It should add to your understanding that indeed He is preeminent. Verse 23, if indeed you continue in the faith, stable, steadfast, not shifting from the hope of the gospel that you heard, which has been proclaimed in all creation under heaven, and of which all I, Paul, have become a minister. Confidence that is stable, steadfast, not shifting from the hope of the gospel. People see in this, and it's a problematic phrase, this qualifying statement, if you continue. The suggestion is that by continuance, that you are earning something or that you are keeping something. That is not at all what this is saying. It is saying that by continuance, you are demonstrating your genuineness. Now, the implication of that is that the absence of continuance would suggest the lack of genuineness. And I think that is true as well. What he is telling us is that when we have genuinely been transformed by the working of Jesus Christ, it changes everything in how we live, how we think, how we feel. It goes back to what I was talking to you about early on, and so now he's bringing it full circle. He says, by continuance, you demonstrate. You're demonstrating the reality of what is in you. And I promise you that if the only way you can hold on to your salvation is by being stable and steadfast and continuing in the way he is describing here, and you decide that even though you don't really have a genuine faith, that you want to be saved and you don't want to go to hell, and so you're going to live your life this way, I promise you, you won't. Because you can't. You didn't up to this point. You haven't been changed, and so you're not going to after this point. And even though you have been changed, even those of us who have been changed by God's grace, still struggle. So that along with the Apostle Paul himself, we do the things we hate, and the things we love, we struggle to get done. I'm telling you that continuance is not about perfection. It's not about earning something, and it's not about hanging on to it. It is about the evidence of trust. Our faith, our steadfastness, our stability doesn't mean that everything else is perfect around us. It has nothing to do with circumstantial truth. It has everything to do with the eternal truth. So you can be a flaming hot mess, and you can still be stable and steadfast, continuing in the truth. If that's not true, we're all in a lot of trouble. Continuous to the gospel, of the gospel to all creation, Paul says, I have given my life to this ministry. Haven't we all? That's who he's called us to be. That's what he's called us to do. All of it, though, revolves not around ministry, not around you, not around me. It all begins with the preeminence of Jesus alone.